You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
First of all, I'd just love to welcome Paolo Tiramani, who's the founder of Boxable, to the Hooked on Startups podcast. And much to my horror, Paolo's actually not from round here. So my English accent is going to have no effect on you whatsoever. I can't, it's like the magic doesn't work. Not that it any works, it works anyway. I've been rumbled. Paolo, welcome to the show.
Bye. Very, very nice to meet you. And yes, I may be slightly invulnerable to your accent.
So, normally, it's like people don't listen to what you're saying, thank God. They just say, no, that just sounds really intelligent. And after a while, you go, well, might as well use it. But then the problem is you just stack up this tidal wave of people who say, well, hang on, when you spoke to me the other day, you said this. That's not true. So I said, no, that wasn't me speaking. That's what you heard.
That does what happens. It does give an aura of credibility. I remember at one point, I was asked if I knew the Queen, in all seriousness.
I've just had tea with her, actually, yes. Yeah, that's right. And, the problem is with all of these shows, like The Crown and all these other shows about Diana and, my wife is sitting there watching and saying, such and such, is he the nephew or the great aunt of... And I go, I don't know. And what's a Viscount? I don't know, but the only thing I know about Viscount is actually spelt Viscount, and that's all I know about that. So I have absolutely no knowledge about our history, other than the fact that I know where the Queen lives, and I can probably name a couple of prime ministers. But anyway, all that aside, I mean, for those of you watching in black and white, behind Paolo is an enormous factory that goes on so far it actually has this, vanishing point right where Paolo's right index finger is. This all goes on like one of those mirrors that look into mirrors that look into mirrors. And I think your factory is not measured in square feet. Is it square miles you now measure it in?
Yeah, well, especially it's an eighth of a mile long. It's 4 acres under a roof, about 172,000 square feet. Just to give you an idea of the scale, we now have a factory that we're just starting to plan in the 4 million square feet range, which is leagues larger than this 172,000 square foot factory. So the factory is still, as large as it is, we consider it a prototype factory, even though it can make thousands of products a year. We will be rolling into 100% full automation. That's the way to get the price down. So, sort of learning our craft here behind me with this big giant baby.
But again, all babies are born and all babies are conceived. So babies are not born, the size of this sort of factory. So where was the conception? Where was the idea? And how did it grow? Because to give you some background, this is for my viewer or my listener. The Elon Musk, I think, has adopted Boxable. So it is an absolutely significant sea change in the way that properties are constructed. And the word disruption doesn't do justice to what you're doing. It's an enormous change to construction techniques, costing, and everything. So where did this begin?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you the sort of abbreviated version. I owned and ran a company that was intellectual property licensing, just really a fancy way of saying that we invented stuff and licensed it to industry in the same way that perhaps a book author or a musician would get a royalty every time their product is used. We would do that with products. We did it in a number of industries, and it was a great business. It really taught us how to invent, how to engineer, industrial design. I'm a designer by training. And a few years ago, I really felt that I wanted us to become operators in a space rather than licensors to others. And so, if a bookkeeper can count, it doesn't matter what they count, then engineers and inventors should be able to find a space. So we really approached the problem rather clinically and said, okay, well, we're not the Me Too guys, and we're going to invent, and let's do some good while we're at it. And if we're going to find a problem, be operators in a space, let's find the biggest problem we can. And that actually took a little while to do in and to itself. And then we came up with the fact that building construction was in a pre-industrial condition. This is really sort of top-level stuff in terms of manufacturability. Everything we make in our modern world, and I do mean everything, is made in a factory, and we've all become very used to all the benefits that that produces in terms of quality, low price, immediate, instant gratification. Except with manufacturing, which is the manufacturing of homes, which is done out in an open field. And you wouldn't expect someone to, if you order a car, you wouldn't expect a bunch of guys to show up with some,
with some planners,
and say, where's the shed? And we'll start putting this together. But that's what we expect. And the reason for that is because, buildings are big. So that was the absolute genesis. It was rather clinical. And it took a few years with the previous company, actually, just for us to define what the problems are. So that's the first thing you have to do when you start any new product. You have to identify the problems and not try and fix problems that aren't problems. So just the identification of the problems. And it is such a sort of Byzantine rule book. You know, we have 50 states, et cetera, et cetera. That took a few years. Yeah. And then when we felt that we kind of had a handle on that, we were in New York at the time. And we packed ourselves up to move west to set up the Boxable company and the Boxable plant.
Because there have been a number of attempts at this type of manufacturing. I think, if you look at containers, for example, if you look in some of the Baltic states, there have been developments which I think have used other materials. There have been, a number of different companies, I think, that have tried to create prefabricated buildings. And there's something fundamentally different that you're doing, because, and I don't think it's down to timing or regulation or anything like that. There is clearly something that really defines what you're doing compared to these other companies that haven't been successful.
Yeah, absolutely. The current landscape, I can run through it really, really fast, top down from the best quality we have. It's the modular companies. The modular companies, that's the highest standard, actually, in terms of certifications. They are all, without exception, stick building under a roof. And by sticks, I mean 2x4s and panel sizes that you can put in the back of a pickup truck. All the legacy problems you have in the field, they've brought all of those legacy problems into their factory. So they're not really making good use of their factory or idealizing their factory in terms of production and speed. And the other thing is that they're shipping wide loads. We're allowed to ship 8.5 foot wide around the world. These guys are shipping 14 foot wide. So they're limited to a couple of hundred miles radius from their factory. So that's another big strike against that. And then the third and probably biggest sin in my book is that the owner of that home or that building has to live with these narrow 14 foot rooms as a legacy issue of a one-time transport. And then they have to live with that for decades. It's not a width that works. So that's the modular space. Going down from that, we have the HUD manufactured housing. They're built to a lower code. That's not acceptable to us. We're looking actually to at the federal level to implement a higher code than the modular code, not a lower level like the HUD code. And then we get down to the niche products. Containers are interesting. They look great in pictures, but they're 8 foot wide. And if I outstretch my arms, that's 6 foot wide and the ceilings are 8 foot tall. You can't live like that. And by the time you've sheathed it on the inside, on the outside, you've got rid of the thermal bridging. You've got nothing left. You may as well take away the idea you originally thought of. You may as well sheathe the inside, sheathe the outside and throw the container away. Yes. And then the tiny homes folks love us. We're a building technology, which with our first consideration, with our first configuration, which is a studio home, but we're not a tiny home company per se, but the tiny folks do love us. And as a product, I think that the tiny homes are just a reaction to folks wanting their freedoms, to have mobility, but mostly price. But I think it's a bit of a road to a fast divorce, living in such a small space if you're living with a partner. So, the Boxable products, is a construction technology. As I mentioned, and the first configuration is a studio home.
And I think that's the most important thing to get across, whereas all of the people that have come before you have tried to produce a range of properties, like, you know, you've got A, B, C, or D. Which one do you want? What you're creating is a technology that can presumably be applied to any design configuration. So tell us more about that, the technology, and just looking behind you. And you talked earlier about full automation. So what does Boxable build?
Right. So it's a big country. It's a big world. And there's a lot of different flavors, architectural styles. And the approach that others have taken is a fixed configuration. So, you know, come and live in my contemporary, come and live in my A-frame, come and live in my colonial. Well, we don't say that. We say we're going to give you a beautiful building that's architecturally neutral, and then you can dress that building on the exterior however you want. And unless you're living in an igloo, we're all living in boxes. We're all living in rectangular, yes, rectilinear rooms, irrespective of architectural style. So the Boxable technology does all of the heavy lifting. The best way to think of Boxable is Legos. We played with those as children. The casita, which everybody's very excited about, you can imagine the little square Lego.
Yeah.
Make it analogous to that. And then there's the rectangular one. Yes. We'll be building that, which is double the size. And then there's the one in the middle that nobody uses. And we're making all three sizes of those. And our technology basically makes rooms. The rooms can be subdivided, as we have with the casita, and they can be stacked, connected. They can be cantilevered to create very inexpensive porches and decks. And they can be configured to have any architectural style. They can be used exclusively, or they could be used as part of another system. If you want a large atrium space, for example, you can surround the atrium space with Boxables. So it's a very, very flexible system, and it's approached sort of at the genetic level to fix the building construction problem. And you can't fix that with one style of home or one style of office building. So we've created building shells that are very connect to build pretty much anything.
Yes. So there's no sort of maximum size constraint. So again, using your Lego, you know, example, you know, you're shipping these units, they're transportable across the US because of the size. Presumably when you get to the construction site, you need a team of people to assemble them, but the assembly process is far quicker than, you know, a traditional building, even if that building's using prefabricated panels.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we talk about size, the largest building shell that we will make will have make it a little bit abstract when you talk about numbers with your listeners and viewers. But the largest building shell will have a 40-foot clear span, 20-foot on the narrow side, and a 9.5-foot ceiling. That's a huge room, and that can be assembled with others to create pretty much anything. So there's really no space constraint. They're very, very generous. And the windows and doors can be cut out pretty much anywhere with no header. A header, for your listeners, is when you cut a hole in a stick frame building, which doesn't have a lot of strength anyway. You put a big giant piece of wood or steel above it. Our panels are so strong, you just cut windows and doors in. You don't have to worry about that. So you've got, you know, total freedom. And the whole building system is set up on a grid, back to that Lego analogy, so that when you line up windows and doors on the grid, everything lines up. There are, within the walls, smart, I actually hate that word smart, but yeah, they're smart walls, that they have something called chases. Chases are holes that run through all the walls, ceilings, and floors at predetermined intervals, so that when you stack Boxables, the chases for the wiring all connect. And when you go side by side, those chases connect. And even if you offset them, how can I show it to you?
I can understand. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
They still connect. So it's very, very interesting. And when they get out to the field, you know, what we say is we've done the heavy lifting for you, and you've just got to put these things together. In the future, they may come as empty building shells, or they may come fully configured with staircases, closets, bathrooms, bedrooms. And we're just starting out with this adorable little guy, this studio, 400 square home, which seems to have caught the public's attention, called the Casita. Yeah. But in terms of all the problems we've approached of the marketplace and the construction building industry, you know, we look at everything, any project we undertake, we look at it as a sort of a problem pie, and we slice up the pie, and it doesn't matter if it's a big problem or a little problem. I mean, we're going to weight it and attack the big problems first. But sometimes you got to put a big problem on pause, fix a little problem, and then that throws light on the big problem. So it's a big problem pie. We slice it up, and then we put people into teams to address those problems. And you know, it's very interesting. There's no problem too large or too small. You mentioned when the product arrives, how is it set up, for example? And there are a lot of secondary costs to construction, and there are a lot of secondary costs to deliver the product. So, for example, I'll give you a couple of examples. When our product is delivered, it does not require any coordination with the homeowner or the builder. It does not require a crane on site. A crane is expensive, hard to maneuver. The guys have to have special certifications. Our driver, by himself, you just point and he'll drop it off. He doesn't even need level ground. And then when the box wall needs to be moved, again, no crane, you can move it with something called a telehandler, which is an oversized forklift. And then with the unpacking of the box wall, again, broken record, no crane, we will have available to buy or rent some bracketry with some hoists and electric controllers. And two guys, the brief was to have two guys, some bracketry, electric winches, run off a car battery or 110 outlet, can unpack the home and button it up, or unpack a building shell, I should say, and button it up in about an hour or two.
And the longevity. So, I mean, obviously one question that springs to mind is how does this compare to other buildings in terms of, you know, how long it lasts in the various different weather conditions that you have, you know, across the US?
Yeah, great question. So a good way to look at it is, again, with field construction, they are putting together wood frames, typically they're going up ladders, banging nails in the heat, in the cold, the frame gets rained on. Like, we're in the desert, it's boiling hot, the guys can't work. You know, in New Hampshire, it's going to be terribly cold and get rained and snowed on, and they warp. And then they're put together with little bits and pieces, drywall, plywood, etc. We don't do that. We don't have the constraints of the limits of human strength. We have a big factory, just like every other industry has a big factory. We have giant machines, and we can make panels in 40-foot lengths in one piece, in one big solid piece. We don't use stick framing. It's completely antiquated. We use a process more similar to how airplanes are constructed with
laminate. Well, I see the large sign that says lamination. So I guess it's that kind of sort of honeycomb effect.
Yeah, exactly. And laminates are sort of a magical thing. I can describe it very, very, very quickly. Laminates are just a layer cake. We put down layers of materials. In our instances, we put down a layer of concrete board, steel, insulation material. We might additionally put some hinges and other elements in, magnesium oxide board. And every layer that goes down, we stroke glue across, and then we put another layer, and it's our own cocktail. It's taken a very long time to make simple, and we arrive at this 6-inch wall panel. And the beauty of laminates, if I can describe it very simply, is that when you put two materials together like this and you put glue in between, and then you put a point load to bend it, you know, to make it strong, you know, wind, the people standing on it, bathtubs, whatever, full of water. And what's happened is, those materials, when you put a point load in, all that glue tries to push those two laminates sideways. Yeah. And there are layers of glue. And so it really is quite magical that all that surface area of glue is not going to allow those two materials to slip past each other.
Yes.
So we have a laminate panel. It is immensely strong. And to make the point, traditional homes need a strong foundation, a strong basement, so that you can put all these wobbly sticks up, and it's the foundation holding up the house.
Yes.
So we have to have a foundation because the local municipality says we do, but that's almost an antiquated regulation we don't need a foundation. You can hold this up in the four corners. It's that strong. So, and then in terms of overall strength, you know, hurricane ratings and things like that, we're going through now with NCAA, our certifying body, and we will have significantly higher strength. Every metric we will be, frankly, in terms of strength, but it's also in terms of moisture. Bugs can't eat it. And again, all the slices of that pie to make a superior panel.
So are you telling me that termites do not dine out on magnesium oxide paneling?
They do. They turn into sort of mutated termites.
That's right. So you could be responsible for these sort of giant termites that are... You know, but I, in all seriousness, if one thing that I noticed coming from the UK to the US, God knows how many years ago, was that every, you know, you'd knock on a building wall. Now, particularly in California, this is, you know, these sort of multi-million-dollar homes, and it, you could actually feel the house sort of wobble slightly, and just felt very peculiar that you had these, that all of the homes were, you know, the walls were 6 or 7 inches thick at the most, and you close a door upstairs and the window would rattle downstairs. What you've got is something that really is saying that that is, A, it's a construction technique which was really derived primarily out of cost, I would have thought. And there's some nod towards, you know, earthquake and, you know, hurricane resilience. But, you know, essentially, the buildings are fragile to start with. It's a giant pile of food for termites sitting on a, you know, on a concrete block. And so the construction materials that you've got really is the difference between Amelia Earhart's, you know, plane and, you know, the latest, you know, sort of 727. But my question really is, for there is a question in all this, when you come across these antiquated processes, you've got antiquated regulations sitting around that. Is that the biggest challenge? You know, trying to convince all of the people that, that have the vested interest with the current code to allow you entry into what is probably a very protected marketplace in 50 different states?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think it's a barrier to entry. It is a hurdle. It is a classic sign of an underdeveloped marketplace. It's a classic sign of an underdeveloped marketplace. You have these Byzantine rules state by state. We don't have that with cars. You don't have that with shirts you buy. We don't have it with anything else. We see it as an opportunity rather than a problem. Obviously, it causes us friction now because we have to go and get our certs state by state. But in the long run, I'm sort of happy about it. Yeah. So I wouldn't say that that's the biggest challenge. I had exactly the same experience you did coming from the UK.
Yeah.
Originally, you know, and we're flag waving Americans now. Back there, there's a giant 80-foot American flag. You probably can't see it. But yeah, you know, up in the UK, they would have little bricks, and they'd put up a row of bricks, and then they'd have an air gap, and then they'd have another row of bricks. And they were built like brick, you know what, frankly.
Yes.
It was come to America a long time ago, and I had the same experience as you. I knock on the wall. I'm like, well, that feels a bit flimsy. And with the for the reasons we know, and with the Casita product, with the building shells that we have, with these laminates, these things are rock solid. I mean, they're built steel, concrete, and insulation. And the other thing we have, you know, in terms of doors shutting, and you hear it, you know, three rooms over, our building shells, when you put them together, they actually have two walls. It's a wonderful thing. So if you're building a mid-rise apartment and you stack them five high, three high currently, your ceiling is not the floor of the toddler rolling around on his tricycle upstairs. He's got his own floor. Yes. Separated by a gap, so you don't hear it. And even in homes, or you know, if your neighbor's sort of having a rave next door or doing whatever, you're not going to hear them because there are two walls with an airspace between you and the neighboring apartment. And that goes on and on, you know, with single family homes. If you've got rowdy teenagers having a good time and the parents want to watch a quiet movie, it's not a problem. It's a tremendous amount of insulation and rigidity. And that's born out of the fact of the way we build the product, but also the product has to be not only transportable, but we've engineered our product to be transportable and retransportable. Yes. That's the word. We've engineered building shells to pack, unpack.
Yep.
And when they unpack, they are indistinguishable from a regular home. I would say they're a higher quality, but there are no visual clues that you have unpacked the home. It's just a big, beautiful, white interior. And so you can pack them up. So it sort of changes your mindset about the investment a homeowner is going to make in their home, if they realize they can take it with them, if they don't like their neighbor, if they don't like their changing horrific state or local tax codes, or they get a job that's better for them in another part of the country, they can take it with them. They can take it with.
And again, you can see the knock-on effect of this is, so, you know, when you start changing things fundamentally, then the knock-on effect is that all of the other, that there are changes probably that you didn't forecast or foresee. Those changes could affect the way that land is priced, because if, or, you know, if homes become portable effectively, then there are things I can't even imagine. But it's funny how when you start making fundamental changes to the status quo, then, you know, everything else begins to change. And I mean, have you seen any knock-on effects that you weren't anticipating?
Yeah, so that's a really great point, and it's something we're very cognizant of, about the knock-on effects, those that you can imagine and those that you cannot imagine. So when you're engineering and designing, you have to leave margin for the unimaginable. I'll give you some examples. When Facebook started or Google started, they didn't think they'd be where they are now. It's as a fact, you know, the Facebook classically, Zuckerberg just, I think, wanted to find a girlfriend. I might be paraphrasing. Here we are with Facebook and Google. So with us, it's the same thing. You know, we're sort of, we imagine, we are futurists. That's as crazy a word as inventors, but we are both of these things. And so the way we do it is we resort to fundamental principles, resort to first principles. And the first principle is something that can't be devolved anymore. You just study whatever that artifact is. It can be a wall panel, it can be a nail, and it cannot be devolved anymore. And we do that to all aspects of the business, all aspects of that problem pie. And if we use those first principles as a tow line as we go through fixing these things, then you can get sort of hyper-focused on smaller elements and fix this problem and unwittingly create another problem for yourself down the road. It really is a balancing act, a jigsaw puzzle. But if you stick with those first principles, we find that it's the gift that keeps on giving. So with Boxable, you make the really good point. It's like, well, how does this change things? It's like, well, you know, we have reach goals. So we say, we want to see these things on Amazon Prime. We want to be able to pack them, move them around. What are the knock-on effects of that? What does it do to land prices? What does it do to the evil government tax codes? How does it make folks feel about their own homes? And we've scoped out probably 60% of that or less, I think. And it'll be very interesting to see what owners come back to us and how it develops. These things can typically take on a life of their own. And so, you know, we're very keen as we through this development cycle and go from, you know, zero to one, as Peter Thiel would say, from prototype to production, which is extraordinarily difficult, by the way.
It's the combination of inertia and momentum, isn't it? It's trying to create enough momentum to overcome the inertia. And again, in terms of markets, are there particular sort of legislative changes? I'm thinking about the ADU regulations in California. Is this a question of timing that benefits you as well? Has there been something that has made this possible when perhaps a few years ago it wouldn't have got the same immediate traction?
Yes, that's really interesting. We started with the building shell technology, and I think we showed it at the IBS International Builder Show here in Las Vegas, I think 19, something like that. And we showed the you know, two-bedroom home, 1,600 square feet, super cute. Everybody was wowed and we all felt great. And at the end of it, it's like, well, what do we do now? And folks were saying, well, what do we buy? And we weren't very smart. We said, we're not sure what to do now. So after that show, we said, wow, you know, the building technology, the shell technology is far too abstract to start. We'd have to go from zero to 1,000 miles an hour. We need to configure the technology into something that's popular and usable. And we came up with the ADU, just as you mentioned, the accessory dwelling unit for your viewers, very popular backyard granny flats.
Yeah.
And we fit perfectly for that, because if you have a driveway and your product packs down to 8.5 foot wide to ship anywhere around the world, you can definitely get it down someone's driveway. And, you know, my partner and I, we said, well, you know, Let's just make a few. Let's set up shop and make a couple of hundred and see how it goes. So we put it out there. and then boom, everything exploded, and everybody could find a use case for themselves beyond the ADU. So we haven't set up this first factory, we call it Factory One, behind me in the hope that folks come and buy them. You know, we are, we're not here with the folks here. The folks are here giving us an insane amount of orders, over 100,000.
Oh, right. So, I mean, I think in June, it was around less than half that. So, and again, that's a problem in itself. You know, because I know that there are many people who start businesses on the if you build it, they will come basis. And that normally is a recipe for failure. but you have another problem, which is managing growth. So there's all of the, you know, issues in terms of trying to manage not only the, you know, the production side, the growth, but also the people, you know, the regulations, trying to ship to multiple states. So, and again, I mean, I'm trying to avoid the trite questions, but things there that, what piece of advice would you give to someone who is in that same position where what they've done is suddenly of immense, you know, interest to the consumer, but they're sort of snowed under? What approach would you recommend to people to deal with that?
Right. So I may have limited knowledge on that. I do have to just go chuckle about what you just said, because it's so true that, you know, build it and they will come. It's a complete crock of shit.
Yes, yes, it is.
I'm allowed to swear on your channel.
Yeah,
but
you are. And there'll be more of that later, believe me.
So it's so absolutely true. No, they will not come. You have to market it and you have to display the product. So folks have come. The issue that we will be faced, well, let me answer your question about advice. So typically my career has been to invent, and our company would invent and license to folks that already had sales channels and things like that. So in terms of a high growth idea, what we've done is, you know, first thing you need is money. And we didn't go out to, but we tried the venture capitalists. You know, we put in a few million dollars internally, went out to venture capitalists. And what typically happens between, you know, founders and venture capitalists is you may not agree on the valuation. So we turned to the crowdfunding markets as my partner's idea. And I said, really, you think so? And, we went out with WeFunder, then we went out with Start Engine, and we just blew their records up. We were, I think, much number one, not sure in both in terms of raise speed and things like that. So we've not had trouble raising cash, but I think it's been a very unique situation, and I think the cash raise is probably the single biggest component. For us, cash is not a problem. Investment is not a problem. We're very, very fortunate in that. Our problem, I think, once we get this prototype line up, not a line that makes prototype products, the production line, we consider it a prototype, is going to be scale. We're going to be hit upside the head so badly in about 6 months. These guys should be going out the door every 90 minutes, which sounds wonderful, but it's really not nearly fast enough. And we're making plans now to scale rapidly in terms of the size of the buildings and what we plan to do with automation. Really,
I was going to say, because automation is the key. That's going to be the sort of seismic shift, isn't it? Because at the moment, you can have a sort of like a quasi-manual process that's scaled, where you've got lots of people moving stuff around, but in a very big factory. And this is really where I'm thinking about the sort of leaps forward that, you know, companies like Tesla have made, where processes that were previously manual become automated. And I think at that point, then you truly get scale, because, and again, I'm talking with very little experience here, but the ability to automate processes gives you the ability to predict what your manufacturing output can be. And then you become this sort of behemoth that no one can compete with. You know, is that the objective, really?
Yeah, you absolutely put your finger on it. So first of all, you have to design for production, and that's a skill in and to itself. And that meant that we had to pretty much throw out all the manual labor processes that we see in a pre-industrial construction technology business now. And the first thought that we did was, first of all, we we're very familiar with designing for production and high volume production in a number of different industries. The first folks we got in Porsche Consulting, the car folks, because we figured the production line really exemplified by the auto manufacturers, which are very, very complicated. These lot of robots, and it's really very impressive what they do. So they've come in for a couple of sessions with us, cost a fortune, and they've really helped. They were terrific, actually. They helped us put together a production line.
And so, you know that Porsche put their engines in the back. You're not worried that you might end up with sort of windows where doors are supposed to be or something, you know?
We were doing a trailer system. I think we maybe have to come back to them and maybe put a nice mid-engine trailer system.
That's right, yes. The trailer does 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, yeah.
I mean, in terms of production, we have very, very high goals in robotics and speed. And you're right, we absolutely plan on being a behemoth. Our goal to the robot and automation folks that we're just onboarding now is what we said to them is the production line is basically in two sections, let's say. We make the building shells, and then the building shells have to be configured with those interiors. And we said, okay, on the building shell side, which is much simpler than a car, our goal to you is we want to have raw materials in one end, we want to have finished goods, finished building shells out the other end, and we want to turn the lights off. Now,
yes,
that may sound a little dangerous, and we're not really going to turn the lights off, but that's the goal. That's the brief that they have been set, and they're working with our engineers. So let's see a production line that turns the lights off, because now I know it's really an automatic production line. And I believe that there is an inflection point where we get so efficient, the cost, I think, is going to go to a point that is so shockingly low, people are going to be just absolutely stunned.
And that was going to be my next question, because the natural question is, you know, how does the cost of what you're building, if you have a piece of land and you have two comparable buildings in terms of square footage and in terms of, you know, all the other ratings that you would use to compare those two houses, is your home 10% less expensive, 20% more expensive, or how would you compare that in round figures?
So it's a component. The home is the home itself. We take care of everything from the outside of the walls in. Let's say, and there are lots of other things. You have local land prices. Yes. You're still going to put in a driveway. You're going to need to trench for utilities, have septic, city septic, sewer, and things like that. So it is a component cost. So everything is so cost to make a direct comparison, and I wouldn't want to mislead folks. But those building shells are doing all the heavy lifting. And I think that when we get really what we're doing after we get this first production line up is we'll be looking at massive efficiencies. I look at that production line behind me as a product in and to itself. It's a manufacturing cell, and we're going to look to make that as efficient as possible. And then we're going to look to just print them off. We're going to replicate those within our national borders and around the world, ultimately, and have a very, very high quality standard at a very, very low cost. I'm not sure exactly where that will land, but
it's not just about cost, though, is it? Because, you know, we are involved through my partners in you know, small residential construction projects. And look, the problems are, it's not just the cost of the materials. A, it's getting the materials. B, is getting someone to turn up and put them up reliably. And then, so there's all sorts of moving parts associated with the construction of a standard home that makes it very difficult to predict the outcome. So you're taking away most, if not all, of those unpredictable elements, and you're creating predictability. So when you have predictability, then you can forecast, and then you can deliver. So that's what you're doing, I think, could end up being one significant way that housing shortages are solved, because a housing shortage depends on builders and construction companies. So there's all of those. So it's not just about cost. I don't want to sort of mislead people that this is not a direct comparison.
Yeah, the labor cost is, of course, there's a whole bunch of different components, you know, but everything eventually goes through a funnel and exit at costs, you know, so it's not an unreasonable question. But the labor point you make is a very good one. And everybody has the labor problem. What I mean by everybody, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, D.R. Horton and putting up a community of hundreds of homes, or you're a onesie homeowner the Houghton guys have a problem of getting lots and lots of plumbers and electricians out to a temporary factory, which is an open air field, and maybe they'll show up, maybe they won't show up, maybe they were in a bar the night before. There's no liability afterwards. They just disperse to the four corners of the earth, you know, in terms of warranties and such. And the single homeowner isn't going to get those laborers either, because they're going to be working for the D.R. Hortons of the world. So,
exactly.
You know, everybody has a problem. So, you know, what are the time consequences and therefore the money consequences of that? And what are the time, what are the money consequences of having a 9-month build, which is your average build, or a year? And with all of those problems, you know, you have to dribble money out. Maybe you have to hire and fire.
That's what I mean about the knock-on effect. So the knock-on effect is, if the building becomes predictable, then the funding options change. So the funding costs potentially could come down, because people know that these buildings can be built, delivered, and sold within a much smaller window.
So exactly. If you have, I mean, just like the cost of money is absolutely huge, depending on the product. Cost of money is absolutely huge. If you knew that Boxable was out there and you could get building shells on Amazon or directly from us, and you can order a couple of hundred at a time, and you know that they come within a week or so because they're in inventory, you just park that problem aside. You take care of your infrastructure, do your gardening, you put your driveway in, put your street lamps in, and then you order them. They come late. You save the cost of the money, or your back office costs, your architectural costs. One of the really great things, talking about knock-on costs, is, let's say, take the casita, for example. When folks put their casita in, they need a basement. Yeah. We will have those basement plans online. So instead of spending $1,000 or $2,000 with a local engineer, they'll just download it from us. And it doesn't matter if they want a full basement, a slab, pillars. They'll download it from us. It's already done.
Yes.
If we can do something once, and our tens of thousands of customers can utilize that, I don't know, that sounds like a really good deal to me.
It sounds like a good business, yes.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And if we can, so, and little casitas are architecturally neutral. They're very, very plain on purpose. The big country, lots of different flavors, as I mentioned earlier. We will have downloads of exterior finishes for the casita. So if you want to turn it into a contemporary, if you want to turn it into a cookie cutter, traditional, or gingerbread house, heck, we're even
exciting the fact that you can actually build these things in your backyard to your own sort of fantasy design. You know, give your kids the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory that they've always been asking.
Actually, absolutely. We even have, we have a lot of fun here. There's a lot of light-hearted stuff that goes on around here, and I think if you watch the videos of the company, you'll see that we will also have a castle, a 400 square foot boxable castle that you'll be able to download and set it up just with regular materials. What we also plan to have, in terms of those knock-on effects that you've put your finger on, is Boxable U, for want of a better word, Boxable University. So we will have a nationwide a group of installers. There'll be independent contractors that have to get certified with Boxable.
Yeah.
And different levels of certification. We'll have an online school, but we really want them to come to the school in Las Vegas to get certified for a few days. And it's a beautiful thing, because now you've got three parties. You've got us, you've got the certified Boxable installer, and you've got the homeowner. So the homeowner has a tremendous sense of satisfaction, because they know that the installer can't screw up because there's a higher authority.
Absolutely.
And the installer knows that he can't screw up, because he wants more business from Boxable. Because
it's completely the opposite of the traditional, you know, self-employed, contractors who come and go as they please.
Yeah. So we will focus on what we have to focus on, the mass production, the absolute mass production of custom structures when they get in the field, and really changing that marketplace. And we must stay focused on that. But that doesn't mean that we cannot provide. We're not going to go out ourselves as Boxable staff and put up the customer's Boxable casita. But that doesn't mean that our responsibility ends when the driver drops it off. We can provide so many support services, so much structure around that customer. And it doesn't matter if they're Pulte or if they're Mr. and Mrs. Smith in Idaho.
Yep.
You know, we provide the same level of support, because they both need the same things ultimately. And they can save on architects, they can save on engineers, they can get a fixed price from the contractor, from the boxable installer. And the boxable installer is going to be happy as a clam. He's going to get fed customers. He's going to get repeat customers, the same customer when they want to maybe grow their home. They can grow with boxable. And there are a lot of ancillary services that that guy is going to do, that installer is going to do. Some of the things we mentioned earlier, landscaping, driveways, permitting.
Yeah.
And the permitting is very interesting. We have a relationship with permits.com.
Yep.
You can go to our landing page at permits.com. If you're thinking about putting up a casita or in the future one of our products, you type in your zip code, you type in your address.
Fantastic.
Your hand through the permit process. So again, it's part of that problem pie.
Yes.
Sometimes we're providing a solution that's a third-party solution, but it's a managed third-party solution by us. So we are the responsible party, even if we're not directly delivering that service. And we're not too interested about making profit in those ancillary services. In fact, I don't really think I want us to.
Well, no, because it provides you with the ability to sell the main product.
It's an ecosystem.
Yes.
It's enough to behave, but it's actually quite...
Well, no. But I think in this case, it is. Yeah. It's true, but I cannot begin. You know, it is fascinating. And the fact is, this business is. You mentioned your first launch was a couple of years ago in Las Vegas. So, you know, all of this really in the last couple of years or so. Is that a fair comment? I mean, obviously there's enormous amount of work, as you say, years and years of work beforehand. But the launch, the growth, it's really happened very, very recently.
Yes, absolutely. So we noodle on problems for years before, and they gestate for years, and then you pull the trigger and say, okay, let's go. So I would say we hit the ground in 17. My business partner came down from California, moved his family down. We brought key staff from New York, and we put ourselves in a rented office. We knew exactly what we were going to do. This fact, so it's been a few short years. We've done everything since from that point to fully engineer the product, capital raise, lots of partners in terms of interested parties that will be working together with extraordinarily large companies. Setting up this little baby behind us, we has taken 6 or 7 months from the time we walked onto the lot. Absolutely breathtaking speed. And I would say that the company right now, companies shift focus in over time, and we've gone through the R&D phase. Now we're going to the production phase, and I would liken the company to really a controlled explosion.
Yeah.
Some days a little bit less controlled than other days, but it is a controlled explosion. I think you'll see us growing in the next year or two to perhaps 4 million. Plus square feet. We're in the planning of that now, building wise. And even that doesn't
get. Do you get your own zip code?
Well, it's interesting. that's only about 200 acres, but they do have some laws here in Nevada that you do get to run almost as your own township.
As I say, you know, welcome to Tiramaniville.
It will be a very libertarian, freedom-loving land, let me tell you.
Yes. Okay, mate. You're not going to turn it into your own sort of sovereign state at some point. Yeah, maybe in the future. But on that note, I'm going to shift gears. And now, I'm not sure if you knew about this, but we have the famous Hooked on Startups quickfire questionnaire.
Oh, I didn't know. I was not aware.
Oh, goody. Okay. So I have 10 questions, and you can answer them any which way you wish. So, Paolo Tiramani, are you ready? Question number one. What is your favorite word?
Yes.
What is your least favorite word?
Well, I'll have to go with no.
Question number three. What are you most excited about right now?
Possible growth and doing some good. You know, We're not a charity. We're not set up as a charity, but the goal of the company is to do good works. It's to fix a really huge problem. So I would say growth.
Fantastic. Question number four. What turns you off right now?
Government. Government. I don't care who's government. Government just keeps soaking up power to itself. Bit of a side road to the Boxable conversation. Doesn't really affect Boxable, but I think government suffocates people, and I think we should focus on individual liberty, especially today. And it's, that's not a left or right. That's not coming from the left or right. I hate them all.
That's right, yes. Universal hatred, yes. Question number five. What sound or noise do you love?
Oh, probably the alien sound on my phone when it rings currently.
Yes. And what sound or noise do you hate?
I think when the alarms go off here.
That's right. Someone's stolen the factory.
Or possibly babies crying when it's not your baby.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
That probably does not do my public image any good, by the way.
APK, other people's kids, yes. Question number seven. What is your favorite curse word?
F**k.
It is, and I say this every time, it is the most amazing word. So thank God for f**k. I'm not sure if you can, you know. And all of its brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts.
And I've got to add one more just for you and me. And I don't think, I'm a flag-waving American now. I grew up in the Italian. I grew up in the UK. So I'll give you a couple, you know, bollocks.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I had a license plate on a motorcycle that said bollocks. So.
Yeah, yes. I had a website once. My email address was matthew@talkingbollo.cz. And the CZ was the Czech Republic, but it was a...
Bollocks.
And you're right, bollocks is not... It's underused here, but it has that full...
Yes, it's good. It's good.
Question number eight. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I don't think I can do anything else. I'm a bit of a, I might be a bit of a one-trick pony. I'm not sure.
Amateur neurologist.
Gosh, that's hard. I mean, sports-wise, you know, I love sports. I love sparring. I love motorcycles. So I think that's probably not very clever to talk about either. But in terms of skill sets,
well, you could be the next Barry Sheen or the next, you know.
Yes. Well, it's a bit of a short-lived career. So.
Well, there you are. Yes. Moving swiftly on to question number nine. What profession would you not like to attend?
Oh, okay. Politics.
Yes. And my final question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh, gosh. I wish I'd read your question beforehand because I could have come back. Well, if it was Shirley MacLaine, it would be, oh, not you again.
That's right, yes.
But oh, gosh, you stumped me. And I'm not normally short.
Don't worry. You can, as I said, I mean, it's just a bit of fun.
I would say go back. Your work is not finished. How's that? Go build more boxables.
Yeah, something like, what are you doing here? Yeah. You're not on the list, son. But that's brilliant. Apparently, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Honestly, I'm just so excited about everything you're doing. And thank you for giving us an insight into this huge success. So I can't wait. I'm actually really excited now. I'm going to go and, because, you know, things like buying a piece of land, thinking, how the hell am I going to build a house? I think I've got a much better idea now. So, you know, how do other people get in touch with you? What's the best way for other people to find out more about how they can add themselves to the, you know, to the long and growing list of people that you know, want to take advantage of what you're building?
Yep, very easy, boxable.com, and of course you can find out much more about the company, lots and lots of YouTubes, and we have a lot of exciting things, a lot of really, really fun things in the pipeline. I think that your home, you don't think of a home delighting you, but I think a home should really delight you. And I think this home should grow with you and maybe ungrow with you. And I think that you can look forward to seeing a lot of great new technology in the home as well. Really, we can aggregate pretty much everything inside of those four walls because we control the four walls from lighting to your coffee maker and just really a delightful ease of use. So stay tuned. We have a very long product cycle to get through, and we don't even know what we're going to come up with, but I can guarantee you it's going to be affordable, high quality, fun, and very, very exciting.
Wonderful. Well, can't wait to see it. And thanks again. It's been such a pleasure having you on. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.